Today's show is sponsored by Datadog, a cloud-scale monitoring platform built by engineers for engineers. Get end-to-end visibility into the health and performance of your infrastructure and applications. Use their log patterns to view and investigate unusual trends in logs and explore the service map to understand the hidden relationships between your services. You can start a free 14-day trial of Datadog and get a free t-shirt. To learn more, go to bit.ly.com/datadogshirt. That's bit.ly.com/datadogshirt. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Sarah Cooper. She is the best-selling author of the How to Be Successful Without Hurting Men's Feelings, Non-Threatening Leadership Strategies for Women, and she is the author of The Cooper Review, the most important internet website in the world, at thecooperreview.com. That is a fact, statement of fact.
That is correct, and you must say internet website.
Yeah.
That's very important.
Oh, I apologize. The most important internet website in the world. Yes. I started following you on Twitter when you went viral a couple of years back when you wrote about 100 tricks to appear smart in meetings. How did that book happen? Did you just have an idea? Like, did a tweet go viral and that turned into a book and that turned into a career?
Oh, it's a long, long story that began in a meeting at Yahoo somewhere around 2007 or 8 or so. Mm-hmm. I was sitting in a meeting and a product manager got up from the table and drew a Venn diagram on the whiteboard. And it was the most ridiculous Venn diagram I'd ever seen. It made no sense. It had nothing to do with what we were talking about. It didn't help the conversation at all. And I thought for sure people are going to be like, dude, sit down. This is irrelevant and not helpful. But instead, everyone started helping him draw the Venn diagram and telling him what to label the circles. And I was really impressed because he just handed the marker to someone else and he sat back at his desk and went back to, you know, playing on his laptop. And so I wrote in my notebook, how to look smart in a meeting, draw a Venn diagram. I wrote that in my notebook. And then a week later, I think I was in a different meeting, maybe same product manager, and somebody was giving a presentation and they said, so 25% of people clicked on this button. And someone said, oh, so about 1 in 4. And I was...
This really happened. Like, these are...
It really happened. And I was blown away. I was like, whoa. Because everybody was like, oh, yeah, that's such a... It really crystallizes it when you say it, you know, in 1 in 4. That's so much clearer than 25%. And so I wrote down on the same piece of paper, you know, how to look smart in a meeting, translate percentages into fractions. And I put that notebook away for years and years and years. And then when I was working at Google, I moved in with my boyfriend at the time, now husband, and I came across the notebook again. And I was like, oh, I have so many more tricks now because I've been working at Google for 3 years. And so I finished the list and I just posted it on medium.com and it was 10 tricks to appear smart in meetings and it went completely viral. It had like 1 million views within a week and it kind of started from there.
You know that thing that people say on the internet when something is both funny but also a problem and you go, oh, I feel personally attacked. Like I want to laugh at all of this, but it is deeply painful because I have been in meetings personally and non-ironically said, hey, can we just take a step back? What problem are we really trying to solve here?
Yeah.
But I don't feel like I'm full of crap when I'm saying it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I've been in meetings where I've been nodding and looking like I was taking notes. And then I would look back at my notes and they didn't make any sense. But I'm sure I looked very engaged. I mean, we all do these things, you know, like I did the pacing around the room thing to look like I was, you know, taking it all in and really considering everything. Mm-hmm. But I think it's just like part of that corporate culture. We are all sort of putting on a little bit of a show for everyone else, you know, even if we don't realize it, we're imitating each other in different ways. And we all, as a team, as a company, have, you know, our jargon and our shorthand and our ways of looking like we know what we're talking about. And we all are aware of those things subconsciously, and we just kind of do them.
I wonder, is it corporate culture or is it human culture? Like, tell me that it's not that we've done this to ourselves. Like, if you're Dutch and you're like in Holland speaking Dutch, are they doing the exact same thing? Have you done any like international, does this translate to every company or is this like America?
100 Tricks to Appear Smart in Meetings has been translated in 11 or 12 different languages. No. Yes. It is especially popular in Japan.
Really?
I have no idea if they realize this is a joke or if they think that this is a cultural exploration that is a documentary that helps you understand American culture. But yeah, I haven't gotten any residuals yet except from Japan. That's the only place where this has made the money. So
we need to go to Japan, because if there are people, very well-intentioned, very kind salary people in Japan who have like, oh, Tricks to Appear Smart in Meetings, I need to buy that right away.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's really sad because I track, you know, how people find my website. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the keywords are, how do I look smart in a meeting? And I think these are people earnestly looking for help on how to look smart in a meeting, and they're finding my tricks. And so I might actually be making this worse, and I do apologize.
So this has become, this is a culture that's problematic, and you have just made it worse for everyone, because my wife, who is a nurse, is now starting to say, will this scale, as a way of telling me that I'm full of crap.
Well, that's good. Yeah. That's good. That's a good use.
Oh, yeah. It's totally like, you know, the one child is going to go to basketball and one child's going to go to baseball. And it's like, okay, but will this scale? Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, is that what it
My sister is a nurse, and she said that someone said, ask the presenter to go back a slide in a meeting. And so like, I feel like that happens all the time, probably.
It's a problem. But you used to work at Google, right? And you said you had Yahoo before that. So how many years did you spend in tech?
Total about 10. Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, but you're outside of tech now, but you're still like bitingly like cutting into our culture with an eye, as if you are standing over my shoulder in these meetings. Is it hard to make humor and books and jokes about tech if you're out of tech for a couple of years, or how do you get your material now?
It is. It's a lot harder. I mean, the thing that I, when I left Google, and what I really enjoy about comedy and writing is that it grows as you grow. So as your life changes and becomes something else, then what you're writing about becomes something else too. So it just reflects that. And so it is harder to like, it's not my day to day anymore, to come up with a lot of this stuff. I probably will write less about this, going forward and write more about other things that I'm observing, but there's different things that sort of spark it. Like, you know, I was at Google today, just having lunch with an old friend there, and just being in that environment, you know, just brought up a lot of memories of things that people would do. I just remember the security guard at Google takes his job very, very seriously. And that's just the security guard, you know, like he's just guarding the gates going in, but he was very, very, you know, taking his job very seriously. And so I thought that was just, and I love making those observations. I'm always just sort of thinking outside of myself at like what's going on and not really listening to what's being said, but like more like how it's being said or how people are acting. And that's just how I was in meetings.
So much of your comedy is this, it's funny because it's true, but also it hurts. You have this wonderful, I don't know, I assume it's a real quote, but it's a quote on how to be successful without hurting men's feelings, where it says, I only got through the table of contents. It just hurt too much, man.
Yeah.
It does feel like that sometimes. I mean, I'm reading all of this and it's just like, you know, it's funny because it's true.
Yeah, that's what I get. People are like, this is funny, but it also makes me want to cry or throw the book across the room or punch someone or punch myself or scream into a pillow. And it's something that I do struggle with, because I think for me, it's a little bit of an outlet to say the things that I want to say, but in a way that is satirical and tongue-in-cheek, but honest. Right. So sometimes it's just not funny. Sometimes it just pisses you off. And that's something I need to work on.
Well, I don't say that in any way as a criticism. What I'm actually thinking is, do you feel like you're shining a bright light on things, whether it be issues around feminism in tech, or whether it be issues around really being lousy in a meeting, or all these things? They are opportunities for us to change and become better and laugh about it while we're doing it.
Yeah. I mean, a few years ago, I got someone who wrote to me who said that they read my the 100 Tricks, and they noticed that they did some of these things just kind of robotically. And it actually made it so that they weren't present in the room, because they were just sort of doing this sort of performance and not really paying attention. And so they said to themselves, you know what, I think I'm going to stop doing this, or I think I'm going to like be more aware of when I'm just kind of knee-jerk doing something that's not actually helping me understand what's going on. And that was the first time that I was like, oh, I guess I am sort of teaching people in a sort of weird way. It just makes people aware, a little bit more aware. And you're like, knowing is half the battle. And so like you can be a little bit more aware and then maybe you can change things, but you don't have to. And I'm not telling you to change, but if you want to, you can.
That's very cool. I'm looking on Amazon at your new book, How to Be Successful Without Hurting Men's Feelings. And I'm going to include links to your website and the show notes, and everyone should check this out. But rather than looking at the, you know, it's 5-star, 4.5-star, highly rated book, like to be clear, this is a bestseller, but why not look at the 1-stars? I'm scrolling down the 1-stars here. This is fantastic. Completely misleading.
Yeah.
1-star. Women should do the opposite of what this book is telling them. The author is a comedian. Maybe this book is just a joke. Who knows?
Could the humor title maybe have given you some insight into whether this was a joke? I don't know.
The best part is that people are trying to explain to the 1-star person in the comments. Oh. So there's like a thread now.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, with bulleted lists.
Oh.
Bullet. Yes, the book is humor. Yes, thank you for your opinion, bro 182. I'm starting to suspect that this can't be real. This must be you and your friends in the comments, because no one could be this dense.
Oh, but they are. They really are. Before the book even came out, I got someone who wrote me an email letting me know that they would not be reading my book and why.
Oh, good. That's valuable feedback.
Yeah, no, I thought it was very, very helpful. The subject was blatant sexism, and the message said, I won't be buying your How to Be Successful Without Hurting Men's Feelings. If I wrote a book called How to Be Successful Without Hurting Women's Feelings, no publisher would touch it, and I would be lambasted for writing it in the first place, even when calling it satire. What appalls me the most is not that you wrote it, but that most men will ignore the blatant sexism, uncomfortably laugh it off, and pretend it doesn't hurt, because that is somehow more manly. But I'm man enough to call you out on it, Sarah Cooper.
The idea that that's a valuable use of someone's keystrokes, like I talk about productivity and like being a productive person, and you have a finite number of keystrokes left in your hands, like before you die. Though that person just gave you the gift of 2,000 of their wasted keystrokes. Like, do they honestly think you're going to care? I guess we're talking about it on a podcast, so
I mean,
that's good for them. Kudos.
I just love the lack of self-awareness of men having to uncomfortably laugh off blatant sexism. Mm-hmm. Women uncomfortably laugh off blatant sexism all the time. The uncomfortable laugh. We invented the uncomfortable laugh. That's our thing. So I just thought that was kind of ironic.
Yeah. The I'm looking at your, I assume this came out before the book, 9 Non-Threatening Leadership Strategies for Women on your blog.
Yeah.
It's a lot of, if I'm not sure, I'm not an English major, but this feels like passive voice. Like you take a normal, straightforward thing that someone would say, that I would assume anyone should be able to say, this has to be done by Monday. And then you just add a lot of fluff around it to make it non-threatening. What do you think about maybe getting this done by Monday? That would be bad writing.
Yeah, it was good in Office Space, though.
Yeah,
exactly. The boss in Office Space, I guess, kind of talked like that a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think about coming in on Saturday? Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's actually just how I would sort of change how I talked sometimes in order to be more approachable when I became a manager. And I noticed it a lot too when I managed women who were very headstrong and passionate and had a lot of ideas, that people would complain to me about them in a way that I know that they wouldn't complain about a guy who was just as passionate and excited. So this all came from, yeah, very true experience.
Yeah, I'm a somewhat new manager, and I have 2 men and 2 women that work for me. And I am trying to consciously think about how I interact with them. And I do often hear from the women and sometimes from the men that they don't want someone to send feedback that they're being pushy, right? Nobody wants to be pushy.
Right.
And it's interesting how in our culture, somehow saying matter of fact, straightforward things like, I have an idea, could be thought by any gender as being threatening.
Right. Yeah.
You know, And I, as a Portlander, I'm from Portland, which is basically Canada. When I interact with New Yorkers, I'm finding myself being passive as well. And I wouldn't say I have an idea. I'd be like, I'm kind of just thinking out loud here, just spitballing, yeah, just brainstorming.
Yeah.
When did I become so passive?
Maybe somebody hurt you. Maybe you
who hurt you?
Maybe you got some feedback, some negative feedback that made you think that you needed to be nicer. Maybe you're just a people pleaser. Maybe you want people to like you, and so you're doing things like this. I mean, do you use a lot of exclamation points and smiley faces in your emails?
Yeah, it's all hearts and winky faces. I don't know. I'm not good at emoji.
I don't speak emoji.
I'm doing it very wrong. But it's interesting because what's happening is women are being taught or ingrained, or the culture is such that they're feeling that they need to have these non-threatening things. And then you play that tape over and over in your head, and then it's baked into your persona. You have to work to undo it.
Yeah, you have to work really hard to undo it. And I think that like mentorship is good. I think women mentoring other like younger women helps a lot in that situation. But if a woman who has gotten as far as she's gotten to become a mentor got there because she was able to tone her voice down, then she's just teaching that to the people that she's mentoring as well. So it can be a thing that kind of just doesn't go away. Although I feel like it is going to go away just as more women join the workforce and become more visible and become like are comfortable being themselves. Then it's not like, oh, she's a angry, bitchy woman. It's just like, no, she's pissed off. That guy's pissed off. She's pissed off. No big deal. Kind of like being okay with emotion in general in the office.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. But ultimately, while the office is overwhelmingly male, the problem lies in my lap, not in anyone's, you know. Certainly great if someone can modulate their tone and just try to be straightforward, but I need to not take it as being threatening in any way. Like a simple statement like, have this report done by Thursday, is literally just what it is. There's nothing underneath that.
Right. But everybody is so sensitive to tone. And I think they're even more sensitive when women are speaking. And that's why women get called out more on like their tone or how they're coming across. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I think that's it does get exacerbated in the corporate world because everybody's so passive aggressive sometimes.
Yeah, that's so challenging because the Slack back channel in the meeting, it's like virtually rolling your eyes.
Yeah.
About the person that's talking right now?
At Google, we had a weekly meeting, a company-wide weekly meeting. And while the meeting was going on, like literally Larry and Sergey would be talking, there'd be like a live stream of memes being made that would be making fun of what they were talking about in real time. So like that was like the culture, which I loved because like nothing was sacred. They would make fun of literally anything or anyone. And I thought it was great.
Hey, folks, you're a very good developer, probably. Regardless, you do write bugs. That's unavoidable. What is avoidable is wasting time trying to track down the cause of those bugs. Sentry.io provides full-stack error tracking that lets you monitor and fix problems in real time. You can see the severity and the scope of the error, get immediate access to the stack trace, connect the problem to the commit that caused it, and fix it without delay. Sentry, it's a name so common that they have to include the top-level domain in their advertising to make sure you remember it. Sentry.io. That's Sentry.io. Open source, full stack, web apps, native apps, mobile games, smart oven mitts. If you can program it, they can make it far easier to fix any errors you encounter with it. Your code may be broken. Let's fix it together. Visit Sentry.io. So I'm looking at the CooperReview.com, which everyone needs to immediately go and check out and bookmark. Who is drawing all the art? Is this all you?
So this is me, but it's a hack. I wanted to draw because I love, we were talking about the oatmeal before, I love the oatmeal. And so I wanted to turn 10 tricks into an illustrated post. It was all text at first. And so I couldn't figure out how to freehand draw. And so finally I just got this like cheesy stock photo and I traced it. And I just went with that because it was kind of like necessity to just get it done. And it just worked because it's just really cheesy. These cheesy stock photos and these cheesy sort of like illustrations kind of went together. So all of these are basically just tracings of photos.
Really? Mm-hmm. That's really cool. Like, not to over compliment, I guess I'm over complimenting, but that's you've developed your own art style because it's your tracing of the stock photos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's really, really creative. I love that.
Yeah. And in the first book, 100 Tricks, I basically just got my husband and two friends to pretend to be in meetings. And then I took pictures of them and then I traced them. So those are all my husband and my two friends.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome. So here's a dumb question, but you were in tech for 10 years. You worked at Google. You worked, you could still be in tech. You could get that tech money. Why would you quit your job to be a comedian? Because everything I know about comedians, I learned from Miss Maisel, they don't have any money, right?
She's
successful, but no one else is.
Yeah. I just wrote about her because it pisses me off how easy her comedy career has been so far.
Yeah. You just show up and get really drunk and then you're funny and everyone,
Yeah. And
someone famous opens for you.
You never need to write anything because you just make it all up on the spot and it's immediately funny. And that's just what you do every night. And it just is so easy. It wasn't a good choice. I gotta say, it was not smart. It was hard to leave Google, because it's like, if you can't be happy at the best company in the world, then you're just never going to be happy. That was kind of what I was thinking to myself. But
aren't comedians not happy? Like full disclosure, I did stand up 20 years ago, very badly, open mics and stuff like that. Now I just do it with PowerPoint at work, but I have healthcare, which is exciting. Mm-hmm. When you say, like, if you can't be happy, like, is this one of those all comedy comes from pain kind of things?
Yeah, maybe you're right. I didn't think about it that way. Maybe I punished myself as to suffer for my art. Maybe that was part of it. I just really was excited about writing and making people laugh. And 10 Tricks was the first time I had put, like, my corporate experience with my love for comedy. And I put those two things together and it really worked and it really resonated with people. And so I just decided to give it a shot. And my boss was like, if you want to come back, you can always come back. And so it seemed like a bigger risk to not give it a shot than to give it a shot.
That's awesome. That sounds like a very successful, very kind, a very supportive boss, rather.
He was, very, very supportive. Everybody was super supportive of me doing this. And I was, I was having panic attacks and I was stressed out for years. I mean, it took a few years before I was really like, okay, I'm not going to go back to Google. But for that first year, it was like, I could still go back. It was in the back of my head.
Is comedy now different because you can have your own website, you can have your own videos, you can go viral? Like, how much of it is still, you have to be seen by someone famous who then introduces you to an agent, et cetera, versus you can bootstrap this entirely yourself? Just put up a WordPress and a YouTube, and now you're a working comedian.
I think you nailed it. I mean, there's so many people who don't wait for someone to say, let me publish you or, let me put you in my thing. They make their own thing. And it's so much easier now to do that. I made the Cooper Review. It's just like a WordPress, plugin. Well, it was a WordPress theme with a lot of WordPress plugins. And a lot of friends, they submit to places like The New Yorker and try to get published, but they also have, their own websites and they make their own series and they make their own videos and they really put themselves out there. And it's almost like if you don't do that, then you're really not going to get anywhere. It's almost like a necessity now to be doing things like that.
Mm. And does all of this, the Cooper Review, the books and all of that, does that all feed into things like doing events and going and giving and doing actual stand-up and being on like TV and things like that? Is that the goal or is the goal just to express yourself and get paid and have fun?
I think the ultimate goal is to leave everything on the table in terms of like telling my story and being honest about who I am. That's what really excites me because I think that I'd like to inspire other people to share their stories as well and make money. Yeah, I'd like to make money. That would be good too. And the more I do, the more I share, the more things sort of happen and more opportunities come to do speaking engagements or to perform or to create things. So it's been 4 years since I created thecooperreview.com and it's starting to be a place where people know me for a certain thing and are seeking me out. So yeah, it's a good feeling. It's still like, what's going on? I don't know, day to day what's going to happen, but it's exciting.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that is interesting to watch, because I followed you immediately when I saw your first thing go viral, is that I can see, because I followed you at the beginning, that it's an overnight success over a half a decade of hard work and late nights. You know, to someone else, they may just be watching and say, wow, Sarah Cooper came out of nowhere and she's a best-selling author. But the grind, the merch, the websites, the branding, it's a lot of work.
Yeah, it is a lot of work. But, you know, when you make something and it's yours, you're just so proud of it. And, you know, it's all kind of worth it.
Do you go out and do book tours now? Or did you self-publish the book?
Oh, no. It's published by Andrews McMeel. And I did a few events in New York and San Francisco. And now I'm just kind of doing some talks around the country, around the world this year. Some of them having to do with a book and some just other like random parodies of corporate and office stuff.
Yeah, I've been checking out the YouTube. I want to make sure that people go to thecooperreview.com. Certainly, it's a blog. If there was an RSS reader from Google, then we could all use that, but there isn't. make sure that they subscribe to that. Maybe you know someone, you could give them a call and complain about that.
Yeah.
That's unfortunate.
Wait, what?
There's no Google Reader anymore. It's gone. Did anyone tell you?
I thought you were telling me there was something missing on my website.
Oh, no. Your blog is amazing. It's just that I wish I had a product from Google to read it in.
Yeah, they shouldn't have shut that down. I'm scared they're getting rid of Inbox. Are you scared about this?
I don't know. They're getting rid of freaking everything good.
Yeah.
Like Inbox, I think, is either gone or on the edge of gone. Google Reader is gone. Google Plus, both of the people over there are still around, but they're concerned. Like, yeah. They could be gone at any minute.
Yeah.
I noticed that you've removed Google Plus from your Follow the Cooper Review area.
Google
not,
Plus
not
is,
one of your...
yeah, it's over. It's over. Yeah.
It's a tragedy. Not sure what to do about that. They do tend to remove stuff, but you said you were there today, though, hanging around.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good over there. There's people. There's food. Oh, my gosh. The food was so good. I miss that. I miss that a lot.
Yeah. Did they just feed you? Like, is it free or do you, like, go through a...
It is completely free. And if you go on Yelp and you try to find a place in Chelsea to eat, the cafeterias at Google are like the number one result. Like that, those are the places to go eat. I don't know. I just had this like margarita pizza that was just delicious and this like salad that was just amazing. And I had this dessert and fresh coffee and it was just great.
You're killing me, Steve.
It's all free. It's all free. I mean, it's just amazing.
See, I work for Microsoft, but I work from home in Portland. Mm-hmm. So like every once in a while we're recording this podcast, I'll just mute it and scream, shut up, I'm recording to my kids, which is my life. And I'm sitting here with my McMuffin from earlier, which is was not free and not fun. I get so salty when I visit like Twitter or Google and I'm like, y'all kids don't even know. I become like old man who shakes fist at cloud. Free food? It's totally unfair.
Yeah. Back in my day, I had to eat a McMuffin, and my day being today.
Yeah. Exactly. But if I were in the free food group, I would be like, you know, you plebs, why don't you have free food?
Right.
You know?
They should give you a stipend or something since you don't get the free food.
They should totally give me a free food stipend. Actually, I don't usually try to talk too much on a podcast, but true story. One time in the last 11 years, I got to go business class and I went to New Zealand, which was amazing to go horizontally. It's way better than going like vertically to that area. So I'm horizontal. I go there and I come back and then I get in trouble and they audit because it was very expensive. And they audit my expense report and they say it's like $10,000 to go to New Zealand or whatever. And then they called me thinking I'd maybe try to do something sneaky. But then they looked at the rest of my expense reports because I'm super paranoid about money. And it was like Subway, Chipotle, Subway. And they're like, okay, well, no one would really legitimately try to rip us off and not eat these places. Like, surely this is a harmless person. So my entire thing was like, you know, $10,000 ticket and then a bunch of like really bad food that I was eating all over. And that's what saved me from the audit because they're like, you know, if we found steak dinners, we would probably fire you. But no, it was just Subway and Chipotle.
Are you an engineer?
Sadly, I am.
Okay. Because I don't think I've ever heard anyone describe it as it's better to go horizontally. And I just realized that you meant you were lying down.
I'm sorry.
Like who talks like that, but engineers?
Who talks like that? You can feel free to use that. Who talks like that? I expect a blog post later today. Who talks like that?
Only engineers. My husband's a software engineer, and I think he would say something like that.
I bet you there is a top 10 list that we could put together later, because my wife has that. Who does that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the problem is it's infecting the children.
Oh, no. You know,
because it's like, hey, that's physics. You know, like the 11-year-old says something, that's physics, to describe why something happened in the world that isn't necessarily physics that's happened. He's just like, that's.
But what isn't physics? Like, everything's physics, right? See,
and that's the problem with that statement. Like, one, something happens and it's gravity. Hey, that's physics, magic physics. But now Trump opens the government. Oh, that's physics. Like, well, no, you're not using it right.
But aren't you? I mean, really? Yeah.
Well, and then, so the problem is I don't want to indirectly raise little well actuallys.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But little kids are naturally well actually people, right? That's what little kids do. Well, actually, Dad, you know, the Earth is not a sphere. It's kind of an oblong.
Oh, God.
You know?
Oh, wow. That's funny.
It's not funny. It's quite painful, but thank you. Well, your new book is How to Be Successful Without Hurting Men's Feelings. And people should check you out at thecooperreview.com. That book, as well as your previous book, How to Sound Smart in Meetings, all available on the most important internet website in the world, thecooperreview.com. Thank you so much, Sarah Cooper, for chatting with me today.
Thank you for having me.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.